Senator Javits, can a fact-finding commission of governors and senators be expected to uncover new facts in Cambodia?
Senator, do you think that health, education, and welfare will go better under a Richardson than a Finch?
Senator Javits, do you now see recession as a bigger threat than inflation?
Capital Cloakroom. From the nation's capital, CBS Radio brings you the 1,118th presentation of Capital Cloakroom, a spontaneous and unrehearsed interview with an outstanding public figure. This week's guest is Senator Jacob K. Javits, Republican of New York. He meets with CBS News correspondents George Herman, Daniel Shore, and Mariah McLaughlin. First, we hear from George Herman.
Senator Javits, welcome to Capitol Cloakroom. Thinking back over some of your past appearances on this program, I recall that we've used your expertise in many fields, calling on your experience in the Army's Chemical Warfare Branch, as a New York City lawyer, as Attorney General of New York, and a senator for the past 14 years. I don't know exactly what category of expertise to summon forth at the moment, but I'd like to ask you whether you feel that a group of senators and governors can learn more about the facts in Cambodia than the administration's own experts on the field?
I do not. Nor do I feel that they can learn more than the experts of the Armed Services Committees of the Houses, both the House and Senate, or of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate and the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House. I think this was essentially a desire by the President to take a stand before the country that they essentially backed up the findings that he announced when he made his speech accounting for Cambodia.
Are you inclined to back up those findings?
I think the President undoubtedly has told us exactly what was found there. It may be that they've puffed up a bit, though I'm sure the facts are correct. The importance of the military fines and the elimination of stocks and the weapons they've captured, because it's been pointed out time and again, those can easily get back to where they were before from the same source of supply. And if you're going to deal by eliminating sources of supply, you have to do it in North Vietnam as well. And obviously, we're not going to do that. I believe that the whole point is that the Cambodian exercise, announced as the President announced it, simply introduced an element of doubt that the President really intended to get out of Vietnam, that he didn't intend to restrict himself to that purpose of getting out, that he had felt free to expand the war, to undertake actions which could lead to new commitments, even notwithstanding himself. This is what the country's against. Now, I believe, having caught the heat, as it were, he has really reshaped this thinking. And we are going to get out of Vietnam, and I don't believe we're going to get back. But I think that it's important, now that we have had this controversy and the President has made his move, that the Congress make its move, and that is to pass the Cooper Church Amendment.
Senator, do you feel that the fact that Thai troops and South Vietnamese troops will be allowed to remain in Cambodia with financial support from us, isn't that really just saying we're there? I mean, our men may not be being killed, but we're there.
I don't think so. I think the real essence of this country, and which mustn't be lost in the shuffle, is the fact that we don't want our men killed, we don't want our men there, and we don't want any president to be able to say that American honor is involved and that America's in danger of defeat, because that's what leads to big-scale wars, and that's what leads to wars that hang on for years. We're pretty well accustomed to military aid and economic aid. We've given them before in similar situations. We may give them again. But within the context of what the United States has done in Cambodia, there's naturally a fear that anything will represent the continuance of a commitment. So I understand that. And for that reason, rather than for other reasons, we ought to cut off completely money and everything else. But the idea that a permanent policy of the United States would exclude the financing of people who may be fighting for their lives or for their freedom or for the integrity of their country, that I could not accept. But within the given situation which we find in Cambodia, because of the suspicion engendered in the minds of so many Americans that anything you do there, including money to finance Thai or other troops, is only a point of entry so we can go back in, I deeply feel that we have to cut it off completely. And one of the reasons I say that you have to push through the Church-Cooper Amendment, which keeps us out of Cambodia in every way, is assurance. The assurance will no longer be accepted from the President that, well, he's getting out and he's going to stay out. I think the Congress has to lock it in law, and that's why I hope very much that My colleagues will persist. I intend to persist until we pass this amendment. Notwithstanding, any way it may be diluted by some general authorities to the president, as talked about in respect of Senator Byrd's amendment of West Virginia, or in some other way, the essence of the Church-Cooper Amendment, which we must pass, in my judgment, is just to show by law that we don't intend to be surprised again.
Do you consider Southeast Asia, all of it, all of the Vietnam theaters, to be within or without United States strategic boundaries? Is it vital to our defense, or is it totally irrelevant?
I don't say it's totally irrelevant, but it's not as vital to our defense as other areas of the world where we are now limited or in some way restrained from exercising our power because of our deep involvement in Vietnam. This includes Europe, it includes the Middle East, it includes Latin America.
Well, the implication of the question that I really want to pin down is, can we afford to have communist control of all of that part of the world?
We can't, but the question is, can we afford to have communist control of some other place, like the Middle East, which has 50% of all the energy resources of Europe, where it's perhaps a lot more imminent? Is that desirable? Is it less or more desirable than our situation in Southeast Asia? And the answer must be that the more urgent strategic interest is in the Middle East, certainly in Latin America, or in other places in the world. In priority, it must rank higher than Southeast Asia. I don't say for a minute that if we could, we shouldn't do everything we decently and properly can to prevent communism taking over in Southeast Asia. But the answer is that we can't, and we shouldn't.
On the Middle East, the administration appears to be getting ready to give Israel some, but not all, perhaps around half, of the jet planes that Israel so desperately needs. Would that decision satisfy you?
Well, I would not, it would be most ungracious for me to say it would not satisfy me. Together with 75 other senators, we have urged the administration to help Israel, which is in the gravest danger from a threat which is very real and new, and a grave threat to us and the whole world as well, which is direct Russian incursion in the Middle East by its own troops, which is something almost unheard of. But there it is, it's a fact. So I would not wish to be ungracious and say I'm not satisfied, but I do not believe that what is at the moment in the works, or seems to be, without my being privy to the inside secrets, is adequate to do what we want to do, which is to restrain the Soviet Union by a clear demonstration that we intend to back Israel with the necessary power in terms of arms so she can defend herself not only from a threat against by the Arabs, by Nasser, but from a threat by the Russians. That means, in my judgment, that we have to underwrite any attrition to the top flight aircraft, the supersonic aircraft, that Israel suffers, whether it's one plane a week or 10 planes a week. That's the only way to tell the Russians, look, you've thrown a big card on the table. Fortunately, we have a very brave little people there who are just as good airmen as you are, and we intend to back them to the hilt. This is one time when we don't have to do it ourselves, if we have enough brains to see that they don't suffer because they don't have the stuff.
This formula of underwriting attrition, is that something you're just telling this radio audience, or is that something you've also communicated to the administration?
It is something that I think, whether or not I communicated it to the administration is immaterial to this discussion. I think it is the first time I have put it in precisely those specific terms publicly. Naturally, I've tried to orient the administration to everything I deeply feel and think.
What I mean is, what reaction have you gotten to that idea?
Well, that's just what I expected to be your next question, Dan. I'm sorry I can't answer that. But I will say that publicly this is the first time I have phrased the requirement in that way. And again, I repeat, I don't want to be ungracious about whatever the president does. Whatever he does is going to be very helpful. But to really fill the requirements, and I say this publicly and advisedly, you have to underwrite whatever attrition Israel suffers in these high-powered aircraft. That's the only way the Russians will understand that it will profit them little to move into the struggle as they have directly and with their own aircraft and troops.
Let me ask you a question way out of left field, which is this, comparing this to Southeast Asia. Does the president have the constitutional authority to intervene in the Middle East with American forces if he should want to?
Under existing circumstances, that might be the case. But again, these circumstances are literally days old. There is a resolution on the books passed in 1955 called the Middle East Resolution, under which our troops, our Marines, went into the Lebanon. That is directed against any threat to the integrity of any state in that area, and any state, does it name any state, could be an Arab state, could be Israel, in the case when it was used, it was an Arab state, or an Arab Christian state, to wit, Lebanon, if it's threatened by a communist power or a power controlled by a communist power. Now, you couldn't probably apply that definition up to a very few days ago, even to the United Arab Republic. Sure, it was getting tremendous aid from the Soviet Union, but it's doubtful that you could prove that it was actually controlled by the Soviet Union. But I don't think there's any question about it now. There's no question about the fact that it's the Soviet Union frontally with its own troops and its own aircraft that can cause this crisis. So this may be another confrontation which is building up. But again, I repeat, no one, not I, not anyone in this country, not the Israelis, who are certainly the people who are in the greatest peril, are asking the United States to do anything but give them the material with which to deal with their security against anybody, they say. That's not my word. It's Diane's, against the Soviet Union, against the United Arab Republic, against Syria, or any other people who would attack.
Bringing this back to the United States once again, is this a healthy situation where you have the president authorized under a series of resolutions, Gulf of Tonkin, Middle East, and nobody knows when they'll take effect and so forth, and can do various, the president can do various things, or should there be some kind of clearer spelling out of who can do what to whom and with which?
There is no question about that, and I have myself, with Senator Pell of Rhode Island, authored a termination of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which relates to Vietnam, and have been favorable to clearing the books of all these resolutions, according to a resolution introduced by Senator Mathias. And that will, in my judgment, undoubtedly come. It should be joined with a law authority of the Congress, and in a positive way, in terms of war making. I am actually and actively at work on such a measure, and I'm sure it will be before the country within a very short time.
You were speaking earlier of attrition in the Middle East, Senator Javits, with that rather poor transition. We've had some domestic attrition lately at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. The Secretary, Robert Finch, has been named quite suddenly a presidential counselor to be succeeded, assuming the Senate in its wisdom confirms him, by Elliot Richardson from the Department of State. And what do you make of the situation in HEW and at the White House on these domestic issues?
Well, I believe that in HEW, the situation just got beyond where it was feasible for the Secretary to continue. Obviously, he was running into tremendous problems in respect of maintaining his loyalty and fidelity and relationship to the president, and in administratively handling a department where so many of its own employees felt so bitterly about the Vietnam War and about the policy of the administration as they saw it on the desegregation of the public schools. Now, this isn't saying that everything that the department was criticized for is right. In the first place, it really has nothing to do with the Vietnam War. And as to the desegregation policy, that's not all black and white. I personally am quite unhappy with many... what a figure of speech, that's true. I'm very unhappy with many of the things they did, but I think, for example, the initiative in seeking $1.5 billion to help the desegregation process is a good one. But that didn't count when it got to the stage that it did while Mr. Finch remained the secretary. So undoubtedly, that dictated a changing of the administration, a changing of the guard at HEW.
Now, the difference... You think it's for the good, then?
I think it's, on the whole, for the good, and I'm glad, too, that Bob Finch did not leave the government, did not go back to California, but took another job, because I think he's a wonderful man with progressive instincts, badly needed in the policy of this administration, a good friend of the president's, and I think he occupies a spot where his feelings and influence can still be important, and I'm glad of that. As to Elliot Richardson, the difference between his style and that of Bob Finch is that Elliot Richardson is a very good administrator, will run a very tight ship, and apparently that was needed at HEW. There'd be less ideological coloration than with Bob Finch. What we may lose in the innovation and the idealism of Bob Finch, we gain in tightening up on the administration. So I think the change is for the good.
Senator, would you go along with the idea that HEW really ought to be broken up, at least put education in a separate department?
I'm beginning to think in that direction. I was very favorable to HEW when President Eisenhower initiated it. I thought it was a wonderful initiative. You must remember it was initiated for the same reason, that it had to be set up as a separate department because it was just overwhelming the departments which were trying to handle that particular branch of the business. The same thing is now, it seems to me, happening in HEW itself. And it, too, may have to split off education because it's just gotten too big for any one department to look after. It's interesting, but about one half the whole federal non-military budget is concentrated in that department.
Do you think that putting Mr. Finch in the White House may tend to change the balance there a little bit? Most of the president's counselors have been more the right-wing Republican school. Do you think this may change things a little bit in the White House?
I hope so, and I hope the president is doing it by design, and for that reason, that he wants to change it, because I think this would be a very healthy thing for the future of this administration.
Senator Jarvis, the latest thing to come out of HEW, and to a great extent, the product still of the tenure of Secretary Finch, are some proposed changes in the Family Assistance Plan, which the Nixon administration has made sort of its banner in its domestic program for this year. Apparently, in order to meet some objections of the Senate Finance Committee about bugs in the work incentive system, they're now proposing to change Medicaid for the beneficiaries into a kind of a health insurance scheme. What interests me about that is that you have a health insurance bill. And if I recall, in your bill, you were going to phase groups in. By after the aging, you're going to phase in the poor and then phase in other groups. Do you find any conjunction between your health insurance plan and the direction the administration now appears to be going in?
Well, I hope so. I'm very gratified by this direction. I think it's one of the big deficiencies of welfare that it doesn't take account of the rehabilitative effects of helping the poor with their health problems, because that's the first thing that suffers. My grandmother, this is a long time ago, was a very, very poor woman, always sacrifice a visit to the doctor to the necessity for doing better for her children on Friday night, the pre-Sabbath supper. And this is, I mention it because it's very typical of the very poor.
All right.
Pardon?
Appears to have turned out all right.
Well, for the children. But my grandma was a very sick woman and died at a relatively early age, as things go today. And she did it as it were, as a sacrifice. Now, that's just inhuman. So I like very much that approach. It was in my own bill. I like also the fact that the government is going to seek private carriers and pay the tariff at the same time that it works to reduce the cost of health care rather than establishing a bureaucratic system of its own. I think this is, the hallmark of the future. In these changes you referred to, Dan, I am disappointed, however, by the failure to take account of the addition to the basic welfare package that we have in food stamps, because I gather, and you didn't mention it, but you didn't want to make your question too long, I'm sure, that food stamps will now have to be paid for out of the basic $1,600 allowance, which goes to the most poor, as it were. This, I think, is unfortunate. But I think, on the whole, the initiative of the administration is splendid. It's a totally new approach. I shall help it all I can. I think this change to giving the poor medical care through a prepaid health system, national health insurance system, is an excellent change and a very good augury for some form of national health insurance, and I welcome it very much.
One of the ways that Lyndon Johnson, during his administration, tried to help the poor was by trying to bring on an age of affluence in addition to the war on poverty by expanding the money supply, inflating the country overall. Now we seem to be headed in the other direction, pulling back and possibly heading towards a recession or a depression. Do you think that not expanding the money supply is going to have a bad effect on poverty in the country?
Yes, I do. I think it's going to have a bad effect on poverty because I think in a country like this where even population grows, you have to expand the money supply to some extent. We held it practically static for months, and now we've had to expand it. There simply is not enough money for American business to tick over, and you had the danger of a recession by strangulation, let alone by inflation. I think where the administration is missing in the fight on inflation, most seriously and importantly, is in the so-called incomes policy. We have no restraint whatever over wages and prices. This, I think, is very serious. In addition, I think we simply have to review our tax policy. The tax reform bill, which I'm delighted I voted against, turned out to be a very damaging tax reduction bill simply adding to the national deficit at a time when we could least afford to have a deficit and when many could still afford to pay a little more in taxes. Now, these are areas that need to be urgently reviewed by the administration, which is very backward on them, and we must all do our utmost to see that these changes are made or we will have a recession. Also, we need to... Excuse me.
Sorry, as a veteran storm the wind watcher, don't you get the impression from some of the speeches and hints being tossed out from the administration that they are giving serious consideration to an incomes policy?
I'm sure of it, and it's high time. And I would like to say also the same thing for the passage very urgently and quickly of a manpower training bill, which would give some public sector jobs. I sponsor the administration's bill, but muscle has to be put behind it to get it through. These are all critically important. We stand right now at a critical crossroads in respect of the economy. We're either going to change the policy and go somewhere in terms of avoiding a serious recession, or we're going to go the doctrinaire blinker's way that we've been going and have a recession.
Senator, could I ask you two quick questions together? Do you think now that recession is a greater threat than inflation right now? And secondly, you talked about wage and price controls. You said they needed study. Would you really advocate those right now?
First, I think recession is a greater threat than inflation right now. And I believe that we're seeing those signs and an erosion of confidence in the action of the stock exchanges and in the attitude of American business toward their confidence in the future through buying equipment, the automation, etc. And the second question you wanted to know was, am I for wage and price controls? I would like to see standby wage and price controls coupled with an incomes policy based heavily on publicity of unusual or improper price and wage advances, but with the power and reserve to actually impose controls. We are at war, and we've been living for the last 5 years as if we were not, and we've gotten into a terrible lot of economic trouble. And unhappily, getting out of it is going to be tough. And one of the indicia of the toughness is the fact that you need standby controls as well as an incomes policy as I've defined it.
We have about 20 seconds. Do you think standby controls would do any good in an administration which has said so repeatedly that it is against using controls?
I do, because any administration, including this one, will have to respond to stern economic necessity. And if they don't have the tools, they can't use them even when they want to.
Thank you very much, Senator Javits, for being with us here today on Capitol Cloakroom.
You have been listening to the 1,118th meeting in Capitol Cloakroom. This week's guest was Senator Jacob K. Javits, Republican of New York. He was interviewed by CBS News correspondents George Herman, Daniel Shore, and Mariah McLaughlin. Be with us next week when our guest will be another prominent Washington personality. Produced by Ellen Wadley, Capitol Cloakroom originates in Washington, D.C., and only a station affiliated with CBS Radio can bring it to you. Capitol Cloakroom is a recorded production of CBS News. In the know, wherever you go, immediately, because exclusive Net Alert stops everything else for big news over the CBS Radio network station.